This week on Making Contact.
The older, outdated technology has been sent to developing countries where we're poisoning poor people.
The electronics industry produces gadgets galore, from mobile phones that take pictures to the computer we use to edit this radio show. But there's also a dark secret. The industry is one of the world's dirtiest. Its growing legacy is poisoned workers and mountains of toxic waste. On this week's edition, correspondent Brian Edwards Tiekert travels from California's Silicon Valley to Tijuana's Maquiladora Zone to take a closer look at the environmental impact of electronics from the moment they're made to when they're disposed. I'm Amy Pomerleau, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information.
The modern electronics industry began with military contracts, hundreds of billions of dollars to make microchips for missiles and bombers. On the south end of the San Francisco Bay, factories replaced fruit trees, workers moved from canning fruit to etching circuit boards, and local governments did everything they could to accommodate the new industry.
Everybody called it the clean industry. They promoted themselves as the clean industry, not just here in Silicon Valley, but all around the world.
Ted Smith is the director of the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition.
Local governments depended on this industry and thought they could do no wrong. It was bringing in the cash to the tax coffers and was providing jobs and was really thought of as the major engine of economic development. So anybody that came forward with a bad news story was not very welcome.
There was minimal oversight of conditions on the factory floor. Manufacturing processes were evolving too fast for regulators to keep up, and workers had little to no protection from the hundreds of poisonous chemicals they were using.
I can show you my right thumb here. This is from hydrofluoric acid burn.
Romy Manon began working as a production technician at National Semiconductor in the 1970s. The plant made silicon wafers, the chips that drive computer processors. One of his responsibilities was to pour chemicals for the other workers. He still remembers most of the labels.
Sulfuric acid, hydrofluoric acid, ammonium hydroxide, nitric acid, TCE, and then there's TCE3.
Manon's right thumb is scarred and shriveled, about half the size of his left one. Hydrofluoric acid doesn't start burning until hours after it has penetrated the skin, when it's already dissolving bones and nerves.
I was cleaning up the wet decks where we clean the wafers, and that's when I had that acid through that pinhole in my gloves. So I went home that night without having a feeling that I had the acid burn on my right thumb.
When he woke up that night with a searing pain in his hand, Manon called his employer to report it. They told him not to worry. After years at National Semiconductor, Manon was diagnosed with polyneuropathy, a rare condition that's making the muscles in his hands and feet waste away. Although the condition can be caused by exposure to solvents, company doctors told him it was hereditary, not work-related.
I check all my relatives, not only here in the United States, but my relatives in the Philippines, and nobody had this same problem.
Manon has watched many friends from work die of cancer, and the company has always denied any link between their illnesses and the chemicals they worked with. The biggest obstacle to proving that connection is lack of information. Few of the chemicals handled by electronics workers have been thoroughly studied for health effects. When they are studied, no consideration is given to how they act in combination with other chemicals that workers use. And much of the research that does exist is secret, because it was conducted by the companies themselves. It wasn't until two former workers brought a cancer lawsuit against IBM that doctors saw how much information the company had been keeping under wraps. Joe Ledoux has been treating electronics workers for over 35 years. Today, he's director of the International Center for Occupational Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco.
It turned out, after years of denial on the part of the industry that they knew anything about cancer in their workers, that IBM had been keeping a corporate mortality file on every single employee in the United States for over 30 years. It was current. It was virtually total, 99%+ complete. And it had the cancer cause of death right down to the cell type of the cancers.
A Boston University epidemiologist named Richard Clapp analyzed the database. He found elevated rates of cancer in nearly every part of the body, including a fourfold increase in brain tumors. IBM's lawyers argued that the analysis was not specific enough to be used as evidence, the judge kept it out of the trial, and the workers lost their case. Then when Clapp tried to publish his research in a medical journal, IBM threatened legal action. Ledoux says the company, like most of the industry, has always placed a premium on secrecy.
IBM had complete toxicology records for internal purposes on all their chemicals dated 1959. And bear in mind that it was not until 1982 that the State Health Department published its first document even listing some of the chemicals used in the semiconductor industry. So for the first dozen years of my medical practice, what I knew I had to get from leaks.
Ledoux began treating electronics workers in 1968.
Well, I started out seeing a large number of referrals of people who were simply overcome with fumes. That's how high the level of exposure was in the late 60s, early 70s.
He had to learn about health conditions in the factories through his patients.
I started going back to work with them, ostensibly to check to see if it was possible to return them to their workstation. And that was really the first opportunity I ever had to go into a clean room, put on the protective clothing, go through the airlocks, and accompany the worker back to a workstation. I was just absolutely staggered.
So what did you find in those clean rooms?
The level of chemical fumes and vapor exposure was almost anesthetizing.
Pictures of clean rooms show workers dressed in what look like airtight moon suits. But that clothing is not designed to protect workers from the chemicals they use. It's designed to protect silicon chips from dust and oils that workers bring in with them.
You realize that 90%+ of the air you breathe in a clean room is air that's being recirculated, not being exchanged with fresh air.
Why is that?
It's to save energy costs. You lower the dust level by driving the air through paper filters. Now, that's very costly. So they like to recirculate as much air as possible. It saves money and it lowers the dust content even more. The problem is paper filters don't remove fumes and vapors of the chemicals that are being recirculated right along with the low dust content air.
Environmental justice advocates describe sick workers as a kind of miner's canary. They say the chemicals poisoning workers in the factory often affect the surrounding community, but more slowly. Ninochka Roska of the Santa Clara Center for Occupational Safety and Health says unwitting workers can even bring pollution home with them.
When you're exposed to so much arsenicide dust, for instance, and then you don't have shower facilities in the factories, you become the conduit for environmental pollution because you go out, you go to the bus stop, you go home, you spread that arsenicide dust all over the place. So it's always been our philosophy that you cannot have environmental justice without having a safe, decent, and just workplace. It's almost an impossibility.
Residents of Silicon Valley learned that lesson in 1982 when chemicals from one plant began to turn up in their drinking water. Ted Smith of the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition.
Fairchild, like almost all the other high-tech companies in the valley, were storing their waste chemicals underground in tanks. And in theory, once they had used the chemicals, they would dump them into these tanks and periodically trucks would come by, siphon the chemicals out of the tanks and take them to approved waste disposal facilities. In practice, what was happening was that the chemicals that they were dumping into these tanks were extremely, not only toxic, but caustic. And so they just started eating their way through the tanks. And they were mixing acids and solvents, which is a, sure recipe for disaster.
Over 58,000 gallons of toxic material leaked into drinking wells in South San Jose. Residents traced the pollution back to the Fairchild Semiconductor plant and connected some of the chemicals to the high rates of miscarriage and birth defects in their community.
And it turned out it wasn't just Fairchild. It was IBM, it was Hewlett-Packard, it was Intel. It was virtually every one of the major high-tech companies was doing the same thing, was having the same kinds of problems.
Largely due to chemical leaks in the electronics industry, Silicon Valley now has 31 federal Superfund cleanup sites, more than any other area in the country. Under pressure from advocacy groups, the industry has cleaned up its operations, slowly, in the United States. But it's been moving production offshore much more quickly. Ledoux says these companies are exploiting weaker environmental and worker health laws in developing countries.
The older, outdated technology has been sent to developing countries where we're poisoning poor people. Of the 1 billion personal computers that have been made and sold to date, 45% have been made in China. China has become an enormous manufacturing engine for chips and computers. Of the next 1 billion personal computers, which we think we'll sell in 5 years, China will produce over 90%. And of course, China isn't automating anything. They, unlike Japan, just simply sacrifice the workers' exposure to industrial production needs.
John Greenigle, a spokesperson for the Semiconductor Industry Association, disagrees. He says companies are moving production offshore because of massive subsidies from developing countries, not because of weaker environmental regulations.
Obviously, the regulations and how they're applied, you know, may be different from one country to another, but ultimately the standard that is applied and how you meet the standards, the companies have tried to, to follow best practices around the world. I just do not believe that environmental regulations have had any impact at all on where a plant is located.
But those claims are impossible to verify. Electronics companies haven't shared data on their environmental standards abroad, even when faced with requests from shareholders.
We'll have more about the environmental and health impacts of the electronics industry, with a look at the industrial zone along Mexico's northern border, in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information, or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org.
When Mexico ratified the North American Free Trade Agreement, it set its economic hopes on the maquiladora sector. With tax breaks, cheap labor, and easy access to U.S. markets, Mexico would get foreign companies to build factories in its northern states, bringing steady jobs and stemming the flow of migrants across the U.S. border. In Tijuana, television production increased 500%, population more than doubled, and unemployment dropped to one of the lowest rates in the country. But some workers and neighbors of the booming industrial park started getting sick. Lourdes Luján began working for Sanyo when she was 16 years old.
En Sanyo Baterías estábamos en una banda, o sea, una línea, se le llama así.
In the Sanyo battery plant, I was on a manufacturing line. My job was to do the soldering. There weren't any hoods to suck the smoke away, so I was breathing it all the time.
Luján was working with lead solder, often burning herself because she had nothing to protect her from falling drops. She left after 6 months, cycling through short stints at half a dozen other maquiladoras, where she made everything from cassettes to refrigerators. Eventually, she returned to Sanyo.
When I was 19, I went back to work in Sanyo again. I got pregnant. The smoke from the solder started to bother me a lot. That's when I began to have problems breathing. My nose was always plugged up.
But the lead in the solder posed the biggest threat to the child she was carrying.
After he was born, when he was 3 or 4 months old, he broke out in a rash that made his skin blister. And every year he breaks out again, but it's less severe every time. But I don't know if the work I did seriously damaged him.
What she does know is that blood tests showed above normal levels of lead in all of her children. She attributes that to living downstream from the industrial zone where she used to work. At the levels found in her children, the toxic metal impairs learning and development. Many of the people who work in the maquiladoras are peasants who left the Mexican countryside after the government cut agricultural subsidies to comply with NAFTA. At CITAC, the Workers' Information Center, Jaime Corta runs workshops to teach them about chemical safety and their rights on the job. He says many workers don't realize that the factories can make them sick.
In the electronics industry, the workers are predominantly young women. We're talking about women who are 15 or 16 years old, women who are going through a period when they're very likely to get pregnant. And working in the electronics industries with these chemicals, with these degreasers, with these solvents, they can enter into your body whenever you have direct contact with them. And the fetus, when it starts to form, it's just a little ball of fat, which will eventually be the brain and dorsal spine. When these solvents, these defatting agents, enter into the body of a woman, they go and do what they're designed to do. They break up the fat. That's why we see so many children born deformed, hydrocephalus, anencephalus, and other things like that.
A recent study found that barely 60% of workers in Mexico's electronics industry have access to any safety gear. In most factories that do have it, says Corta, the gear is for show. The expectation is that workers won't use it.
At the same time as they give you safety gear, they demand very high productivity. But if you're wearing gloves, safety glasses, and all the other gear, it's impossible for you to make your quota. So, since they don't tell them what effects the chemicals can have, they don't tell them that they have to wear the safety gear, they leave people taking off the safety gear and doing whatever they have to do to meet the production goals.
Many of the workers in the Otay industrial zone can't afford to pay rent on the wages they earn. They live in shanty towns on a floodplain downriver from their factories. Residents call this place, which is not legally recognized, La Colonia de los Pobres, the District of the Poor. They build their homes from scrap pieces of wood and corrugated tin on the banks of a wide stream that smells like cleaning products. Magdalena Cerda organizes in this area for the Environmental Health Coalition.
There are drain pipes that come from the factories around here and go directly into the stream. We don't know if it's rainwater, runoff from parking lots, or toxic waste that they're dumping on purpose.
The pollution, she says, comes in waves.
The water has colors and odors. It's not like rainwater. It's not even like sewage. It has chemicals in it. When you ask people, they tell you that late at night and early in the morning, the water smells like chemicals. Curiously enough, a lot of people say the water smells like cockroaches.
Residents complain that when the river floods, they get open sores on their feet from walking through the water. It's much harder to track the effects of long-term exposure. There has never been a census here. The homes are all technically illegal, and their residents are hesitant to speak to outsiders. Cerda is working on a health survey of the area, but right now the health problems she has documented are anecdotal.
We found 10 so far, children with conditions like hydrocephalus and anencephalus. Another who had spinal deformities. It's a really serious problem that you have so many people with rare conditions in such a small area. It's really telling.
Efforts to get the Mexican government to intervene have been largely ineffective. Maquiladora owners have a lot of political clout. But far more daunting, says Cerda, is the lack of resources for environmental enforcement of any kind.
We supposedly have laws very similar to those in the United States when it comes to air quality and water quality and things like that. What happens is that, for example, here in the city of Tijuana, there is not a single air monitoring station because we don't have enough money to buy the machines. This tells you that even if we had some of the best laws in the world, they're not worth anything. We don't have the technical equipment, we don't have the well-trained technicians and enforcers, and they certainly can't keep up with the way industry is constantly changing the chemicals and processes it uses.
Across town at the Tijuana landfill, a steady stream of trash pickers passes through dozens of holes in a low perimeter fence. Just outside, 13-year-old Ernesto is helping a friend tend a fire they're using to burn the insulation off electrical wires.
We break apart televisions and radios to take out things like cables to burn. You bring them here and burn them to extract the copper. A kilo of copper goes for 20 pesos.
That's about 80 cents per pound. When he smashes television screens to get at the copper, Ernesto is also inhaling lead dust. There's 4 to 6 pounds of it in each monitor. The plastic insulation that he burns off the wires is polyvinyl chloride, or PVC. When burned at low temperatures, it forms dioxins and furans, potent carcinogens that are odorless. Old electronics pose a massive waste disposal problem. Many states in the U.S. are pushing to get old computers out of landfills and into the hands of computer recyclers. But computer recycling itself has become an international scandal. Many recyclers ship old computers to places in Asia where tens of thousands of peasants recycle computers the way Ernesto does in Tijuana. Their tools are just as primitive, the work is just as toxic, but the scale is immense.
What we witnessed was an endless stream of containers coming into major ports in China.
Sarah Westervelt is a toxics research analyst for the Basel Action Network, which produced a major expose on the international trade in electronic waste.
Those containers would be unloaded in major warehouses. From there, trucks would be loaded up. And the trucks would go, from what we saw, into the Guangdong province, into an area called Guayu, which is really about 4 villages. And a Hong Kong reporter estimated that there were about 100,000 people involved, men, women, and children, who would then usually focus on one type of component. So an entire area would, say, just handle printers, or just handle the CRTs, or just handle fax machines.
Villagers bring old computers into their old homes, where they use acid baths and open fires to recover precious metals.
We also saw circuit boards that had had their circuitry stripped off of it, and this circuitry was bathed in a heated acid bath that they call aqua regia. It's 100% acid. They would precipitate out the gold and then dump the acids directly into the rivers. The rivers were black and dead.
Westervelt's photos of Guayu show villagers squatting next to mountains of dismantled computers, cracking open monitors to remove copper, and throwing out the leaded glass in the old irrigation ditches behind their homes.
We did a lead sample, a lead water sample, and found a lead level that was 2,400 times higher than the World Health Organization standard for lead levels in drinking water.
Westervelt says the conditions in Guayu are less a product of ignorance than of desperate poverty.
Many of the people interviewed said they knew that it was toxic, they saw their village disintegrating in terms of its environmental condition, and yet they were faced with a choice between starving or making more money doing this than they could have done growing rice.
The Basel Convention, which the United States has not ratified, bans the export of electronic waste. Other treaties ban the export of hazardous waste more broadly, but the U.S. does not officially consider old computers hazardous. Meanwhile, the exodus of e-waste takes business away from more responsible recyclers. United Data Tech in Santa Clara County is one of a few operations that have gotten a stamp of approval from environmental groups. The facility harvests lead, copper, silver, gold, palladium, and other precious metals from old electronics. Workers scramble around the facility, operating shredders, smelters, and furnaces. Tom Hoagie, the general manager, is quick to point out that the company takes every feasible measure to protect their health.
At the end of the day, they come in to the secondary locker room after vacuuming their uniforms with a vacuum that contains a HEPA filter, where then they remove their dirty uniforms, they have to take a shower, and then they go into the clean locker room, put their clean clothes on, and leave again, so there's no lead contamination.
But the cost of running a relatively clean operation is high. Most of the time, Hoagie has to charge his clients to accept their old computers. Many of his competitors can pay.
A lot of people will tell you we charge a lot of money. Usually for every one guy like me, there's 4 or 5 who are willing to pay for the product because it's going overseas.
Environmental groups have been pushing to make electronics manufacturers take back their obsolete products, or at least pay the price of recycling them. The concept, called extended producer responsibility, is the law in most of Europe. The Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition's Ted Smith says if it's adopted in the United States, manufacturers will begin making their products cleaner and easier to recycle.
if the companies become financially responsible for the full life cycle of their products, that's going to send a very powerful message to their designers. And in the bean counters in the accountants' offices are going to say, if we have to pay for the cost of taking back and recycling old equipment, if we can tell our designers to redesign it to make it easier and cleaner to do that, it's going to provide economic incentives for them to do that.
But that day is a long way off. So far, California is the only state to charge a recycling fee when computers are sold. Smith says even that fee is too low to cover the actual cost of recycling old computers. And after 5 years of tracking computer recycling, Smith sees only minimal progress. The best companies, Dell and Hewlett-Packard, still only reclaim about 2% of what they sell. He describes the industry as a moving target, growing exponentially, moving production from one country to the next at the drop of a hat, and constantly changing the products it makes and the chemicals it uses. And as Silicon Valley begins courting new industries to replace electronics jobs lost to foreign operations, Smith worries that the lessons of the past go unheeded.
I had a chance a few years ago to go to a meeting of the Biotech Industry Association, and I got a chance to ask a question of the guy who was the head of that trade association for the biotech industry. And I said, the chemical industry was thought of as the salvation of modern civilization in the early part of the 20th century. And what we ended up with was a love canal. The nuclear industry was going to provide electricity that was too cheap to meter. And what we ended up with was Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. And the high-tech industry was the clean industry that ended up with more Superfund sites in Silicon Valley than any place else in the country. And I said, so what do you think might be the unanticipated consequences of the rapid development of the biotech industry that you're concerned about? And he didn't even bat an eyelash. And he said, oh, we're not going to have any of those kinds of problems. And I think that's the problem that we're dealing with, is that everybody thinks that these are somebody else's problems and that they're smart enough that they're not going to have to go through the same thing, and yet the pattern keeps repeating itself.
For Making Contact, I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Pauline Bartolone, David Pello, Max Pringle, Eric Park, Andrea Lewis, and Nora Barrows Freeman. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production, funded primarily by individual contributors. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you'd like to support our work, or if you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. For a cassette or CD copy of the program, From Cradle to Grave, The Impact of Electronics, program number 2504, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck, associate producer, Susanna Hines, associate manager, Brishan McKee, office manager, Peggy Law, founding director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national advisor, and I'm your host and director of production and training, Amy Pomerleau.